into the details of Murray's life, but, or even his music, but certainly I'd like to leave some room at the end for anybody who has questions and wants to discuss this further. I'm going to talk more about the process aspect of all of this, but I there's just no way I can avoid not doing some of that, and so please feel free with any kind of questions you have at some point. One of the things, to get in the spirit of this, I would like to start out with at least one selection by Murray before we get started, and this kind of ties in with something I've agonized over the last few years, and that is how, to the average person on the street, obviously has not heard of Murray, probably will never have an interest in him. If you're going to play just one song to try to get people hooked and interested in a guy, what would it be? And I seem to change every week, but this is a song, and I realized how bad I'd gotten about this when I was introduced at a library conference, which is the more typical kind of conference that I go to, and one of my colleagues got up and said, you know, Hoffman's not a bad guy until he gets off on his Murray jag, and I realized the last couple of years have been trying on some people close to me, I guess starting with my wife, but and she does like Murray, but this is a song right now, if I were going to play just one, and this was incidentally Murray's closest friend towards the end of his life, Jim Martindale. This was his pick for the best song, at least artistically, that Murray ever did.
Way down in Cuba where skies are clear, where it is summertime all of the year, they have the loveliest dance I know. Come along, honey, babe, and I'll show you. Get away closer, hon, squeeze me tight. Rag-a-dack to the left, into the right. Shake it up, side by side. Cuddle right up to me as we glide. Ain't it entrancing when you're a-dancing that Cubanola glide? Glide, glide, keep on a gliding, slide, slide, keep on a sliding. Honey, look into your baby's eyes. Throw your arms around me, ain't you glad you found me? Tease, squeeze, loving and wooing. Oh, babe, what are you doing? Ride to glory by your baby's side when you do the Cubanola glide. I'm going crazy, hon, hear that band. Ain't it a daisy, it's suddenly grand. Never heard music like that before. Rag it some more and we'll ride to glory. Pucker your rosy lips, lift the lid. Slip me a loving kiss, oh you kid. Honey bunch, whisper low. Tell me you love me, babe, let me know. I feel so spoony, I'm going loony, don't ever let me go. Glide, glide, keep on a-gliding. Slide, slide, keep on a-sliding. Honey, look into your baby's eyes. Throw your arms around me, ain't you glad you found me? Tease, squeeze, a-loving and wooing. Oh, babe, what are you doing? Ride to glory by your baby's side when you do the Cubanola glide.
Your Billy Murray history. That was a Cubanola glide, and that came out, I think, in 1909, and that was probably the peak of Murray's powers as an artist, at least commercially. He was ragtime was just coming in, and he was almost every song he put out at that point was a top bestseller, at least with what documentation we have from that time. Let me stop for a moment here, and my friend Larry is going to pass out a couple handouts. One amounts to little more than a promotional brochure. I got this from Scarecrow yesterday. I didn't have a book And so that was the best they could do. I had no idea what I was going to get. That's what I got. So you can disregard the advertising side of that, but it gives a little bit of the general information. In addition to the handout, which I'll refer to in a couple points in the presentation, I'm going to let Larry pass out a copy of the biography proper in manuscript form, which I submitted almost 18 months ago. It should be coming out this summer, but if you just want to see physically, it does not include the discography, which is another 200-plus pages, and the appendices, but at least you can get a feel for the general look of it. I hope they make it look a little cleaner on the, I'm sure they will, in the final book form. It's amazing what they can do now with computer-produced type, but that's the manuscript, and there's one copy, and it'll kind of wind its way around as the presentation goes on. Briefly, chronological outline on the book goes, submitted the manuscript in November of 94, and I've been waiting all this time. Unfortunately, Scarecrow Press, which is the publisher I decided to go with, I've done about 13 or 14 books with them. I was asking advice of the vice president of editorial there, and I wasn't really thinking of even going with Scarecrow, although I knew they had a nice jazz series. They have a tie-in with an archive in I think it's Rutgers in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and so I knew they had done a lot of music books. But so I thought I'd ask their advice on what publishers I should go with, and they said, "Well, why not us?" At the time, it seemed like an okay idea. They distribute well to the academic world and to librarians, and that's where I really perceive the market to be, in addition to collectors and enthusiasts, organizations like your own. But unfortunately, about a year ago, Scarecrow was bought out by, I think the name of the press is United Presses of America, something to that. It's UPA for short. Right, thank you very much. It's exactly right. Appreciate that. You don't work for them, do you? I'll have to be careful. But Scarecrow is going to keep its imprint, but this has caused complications, to say the least, in terms of timelines, getting things out, and I really had hoped that I would have something that I could stick right next to Kurt's books in the back table there that you could actually see, but alas, that was not to be. But it is coming out, and we're at the point actually now with the proofs where there's not a whole lot in the way of changes I can make. I just sent in another 12 pages of discographical changes. It seems every month I'm doing that. More on that later, but we're pretty much there. So anything that any of you have to share with me now would have to go into, I think, a second edition of the book. It's pretty well set, and I'm looking forward to it. The first question that has to be asked in approaching a project like this is, why a biography of Billy Murray? I'm sure most of you will be somewhat biased in feeling that the early years of sound recording history could never be covered too exhaustively, and I tend to agree with that, but there's so many other artists, record companies, recorded musical trends, etc., that are deserving of coverage besides Murray. Most of his contemporaries, like Henry Burr, Harry Madonna, Charles Prince, Arthur Pryor, remain inadequately covered as well. Despite the richness of the developmental years of phonograph history, Murray, I think, despite all this, is probably unique as far as the accomplishments that he represents, the truly unique qualities that the man had. And these include, in an era that was dominated by a formal, operatically influenced style of singing, he was pivotal in ushering in a more natural approach. This is particularly apparent in his singing dialogues with Ada Jones, which most of which took place in the 10 years before World War I. He probably left a greater body of recorded comedy than any other artist in the medium's history. He often transcended his material through the mastery of dialect, nuance, and characterization. And whereas most comedians tended to focus on one comic subgenre, his work suggested a talent for all such forms. And the handout I gave you on the first couple pages, it has a representation of just how diversified his recorded output was. Any area of comedy, he truly was a master, and I've included some of the songs which you may recognize, just a sampling in these various subgenres. He also displayed a stylistic breadth unparalleled in the pre-electronic era. After starting out as an interpreter of sentimental ballads, vaudeville comedy, and novelty items popular at the turn of the century, he remained on top singing ragtime and other dance numbers, of which Cubanola Glide was one of the earlier ones. Despite some loss of popularity following World War I, he adapted well stylistically to jazz and band-oriented numbers. In the electronic recording process helped to bring into vogue a softer crooning form of delivery, and while he had trouble adjusting in the beginning, he continued to acquit himself well in that style, and even in the Depression was able to find work when many of the singers of his era had long since disappeared. He was resourceful enough to make recordings in areas as diversified as doing spoken word backup to cartoons, children's records. He even made a brief comeback in the early 40s doing typical Irish type genre songs with Bluebird, with RCA. So his entire career, if you go back, recording career, if you go back to the supposed cylinder recordings he made on the West Coast in San Francisco, I'm not even going to begin to try to pronounce the name of the distribution firm for Edison and the Baca Galuppi. Thank you very much. Going back to about 1897, did that get recorded? I hope it did. But we're talking about almost 50 years, and most of that time, even the supposedly the West Coast recordings were comparative bestsellers throughout the West Coast as well as over in Philippines, China, and beyond, if the writings in Hobbies magazine are to be believed. And although they were niche recordings, the 40s recordings sold well as well. So that's a long period of time to continue to sell records at a successful level. First and foremost, however, Murray was central in legitimizing the acoustical sound process. He was endowed with a particular set of qualities which made him a virtuoso in that setting. His powerful lungs enabled him to project his voice to maximum effect. He possessed excellent intonation and the ability to sing long phrases in rapid-fire fashion without taking a breath, and had an unerring sense for mastering the basics of a song prior to the first take. I've heard that about a few other artists in the last couple days, but Murray truly was, in his period, when you could not afford to make a mistake, you couldn't splice in and cut and paste very well. He pretty much had to start again in the beginning. It was truly a marvelous skill to be able to go in cold and with a minimum of preparation and go from beginning to end with virtually no mistakes. His ability to cut clean, vibrant records gave that fledgling industry the credibility and sales impact necessary to carry it to the next technological phase, that is, electronic sound reproduction. Also of great importance, Murray was one of the first artists to focus his energies on a studio environment. Whereas many of his contemporaries concentrate on live performance venues such as vaudeville and opera, as well as other professions like artistic management, Harry Madonna is probably a good example of that, or record company management, I guess, would be a better example of Madonna. Politics, education, all of these fields. Murray made a living largely from his recording fees. He considered himself a professional recording artist, and that was significant in an era when such work was not widely respected. Finally, he deserves credit for his role in either introducing or popularizing countless pop music standards, and these include pretty much a who's who of the major songs of that period, such as Alexander's Ragtime Band, By the Light of the Silvery Moon, Casey Jones, Everything is Peaches Down in Georgia, Give My Regards to Broadway, The Grand Old Rag, which was later retitled around World War I as You're a Grand Old Flag, If You Knew Susie Like I Knew Susie, Like I Know Susie, Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis, Moonlight Bay, Over There, Pretty Baby, Shine on Harvest Moon, Yankee Doodle Boy, the list goes on and on. He was known as a leading interpreter of his day of songwriters such as George M. Cohan and Irving Berlin, among others. Today's monographs and reference sources tend to emphasize the role played by Broadway and other stage performers in putting across a song to the public. However, few Americans in that day had an opportunity to take in a major stage show, unless they were financially well off or resided in one of the major cultural centers along the eastern seaboard. But many Americans owned cylinder players and Victrolas and purchased the recordings of Murray and his contemporaries. So the sources I was able to find in print really didn't seem to do justice at all to what he had really what he had accomplished in his lifetime. Okay, where do I come in all of this? In May of 1993, a good friend and colleague of mine, Bill Shirk, who's here in the audience, many of you know him as Wild Bill, I gather. I thought that was only in the Popular Culture Association, but I guess his fame sends ripples far beyond just that one group. He infected me with the Billy Murray bug. And in short order, I wanted to hear everything he'd recorded and read everything written about him. The reading part wasn't that much of a problem. There wasn't that much written. But I had little idea at the time that there were 6,000 recordings, supposedly, of the man, and that this would be a tall order to even be able to locate this stuff, let alone sit down and listen to it. Finding very little available in print, and certainly not a full-fledged biography, I decided maybe that was something I should consider trying to do. Again, not having any idea what I was getting into. Once committed, I was confronted with, one by one, with a variety of the potential barriers that would make it hard to carry out this project. For one, the known facts were based largely on the writings of one longtime Murray confidant, journalist Jim Walsh, who's best known for his column in Hobbies magazine, which ran from about 1942 to the mid-80s, somewhere in around 85, 86, I think it stopped running. Although he only wrote four features specifically on Murray, there were three in 1942, and then a tribute at the time of his death in August of 1954. Walsh larded his other articles over 40 years worth with anecdotes and quotes relating to the singer. No matter what song or artist he was talking about at the time, he always managed to work in some quotes or other points about Murray. Most of this material was retold countless times, first by Walsh, and then by the next generation of writers and audio historians. This overexposure tended to overwhelm any efforts at reconstructing the existing data. It also tended to obscure the fact that Walsh was extremely protective of Murray's privacy and either unwilling or unable to tap into the singer's personal side. Despite overtures to write a biography, Walsh died, leaving the Murray story largely untold. In the meantime, his seminal articles had become so hard to find that some Murray fans had indicated a biography by myself would be worthwhile if it did nothing more than paraphrase Walsh's existing source material. Due in part to Walsh's journalistic reticence, there were many gaps in Murray's life story. I found it frustrating that more hard facts existed about people from antiquity like Alexander the Great or Socrates. Granted, these were important people, but we're talking 2,500 years ago, and we were more apt to know what they did in the morning when they got up and brushed their teeth than we did about Murray. Actually, that's not true, because Sammy Herman, one of his Victor 8 co-artists, went into a long discussion about what kind of shaving cream Billy used, and also we do have some of that information, even though how he voted in 1952 in the presidential election. But there were quite a few Murray mysteries which were just next to impossible, and these are obvious things. Things you would know about probably everybody on your block, even if you didn't particularly want to know it. We could not find out these things about Murray. For instance, when did his parents emigrate to the U.S.? When did he and his family move from Philadelphia to Denver? When and to whom was his first marriage? Where, if at all, did he perform while establishing his recording career in New York between 1903 and 1909? Where did he live during that time, as well as during the off-season of his barnstorming years the decade before? When did his sister Mary die? Now, he had four brothers, I think, is the count, and one sister. And his sister Mary was particularly mysterious in trying to track down information. Did she, or any of the brothers, for that matter, leave offspring? Why didn't he have any children? He evidently enjoyed spending time with the offspring of fellow singers. For instance, Quentin Riggs, one of my co-authors, remembers Murray taking Harry Madonna's son fishing on more than one occasion, and both of them reporting having a great time. And why was he so secretive about his early life? These were all things that I was grappling with throughout the project, and most of them, I ended up feeling I had less than satisfactory answers to these questions. Several other factors contributed to these gaps. There's no doubt that Murray was a very private man. In addition, the mass media of the time was not particularly interested in acoustic era record makers. Small town papers would carry blurbs to promote local concert appearances, like for instance when the Victor Eight would come to town. But the major newspapers and magazines and trade publications, even to show business publications like Billboard or Variety, rarely provided space for such coverage. The record companies seemed to be firmly opposed to facilitating the cult of the artist, and they focused their efforts on the publication of tersely worded in-house organs, which would pretty much just talk about the songs. They'd already been held hostage by opera and Broadway stars who could demand and get incredible advances to record, and so they found expedient to promote the song over the singer. And so whenever you would see a little quote review, it would typically talk about what the songwriter had accomplished with this great song, and oh, by the way, it was performed with lots of zest by Billy Murray. Something to that effect. That's about all you would get about the artist in most of these blurbs that would be coming out, like the Edison Phonograph Monthly. This state of affairs made it hard to verify the accuracy of the alleged events in Murray's life. The massive information about Murray's life and career pointed to what was perhaps an even greater problem. He, by and large, lived a fairly normal life, devoid of any major conflicts or tragedies. His best friend, James Martindale, claims that Warner Brothers briefly considered doing a biopic of his life, but one has to wonder if the studio didn't lose interest due in part to this realization. There just wasn't much there to, this would be a lot different than, say, using James Cagney, who would have looked great, I think, as Billy Murray during that later period of his life. Why they didn't bother bringing him in right after they'd done Yankee Doodle Dandy and have him do Billy Murray's life, too. Would have taken a lot of creative license, I think, to have come up with as interesting a movie. The most interesting feature about Murray has always been his music. The wise guy persona projected many of his songs was evidently not at all in sync with the inner man, though. His powers of mimicry enabled him to impersonate a countless array of dubious characters, populating the songs that were handed over to him, and these would include drunks and wayward husbands and braggarts and the like. He's only known to have protested on one occasion to the material was given him, and this was a song called "Nobody Else Can Love Me Like My Old Tomato Can." And he thought that was extremely disrespectful to women, but he went ahead and sang it anyway, and did a convincing job. Now, whenever I think of Madeline, his wife at the time, I see this tomato can, but probably wasn't fair at all. The pitfalls inherent in trying to make Murray appear plausible to a modern-day audience while retaining an accurate perspective of the singer's own era was something that I was obsessed with at this time. I felt this was a major part of the problem, given these gaps that I was trying to deal with. And there were a number of truisms that people like Quentin had to kind of repeat over and over again, pounded into my head, so to speak, to make me see that it was a lot different from approaching as I'd grown up in the 60s with a different perspective on how music was made and what it meant to people. These included the idea that recording was primarily a job for these popular singers in this era. There was very little of the what we now consider to be artistic self-expression, the need to, you know, every singer now is part of their press clippings, this idea that they were born to have to get this message out, that sort of idea. And this was not the way, Murray was a true professional, and that simply was not the way he approached his songs, even though I think you could certainly say that the results were artistic on some level. The stage and live performances were universally viewed, both at the time and now, as a more prestigious part of the business than being an expert within the studio environment. In addition, and this is an area that I know Tim Brooks and maybe some of the rest of the audience are extremely sensitive to, and that is that record charts were not a prime vehicle for communicating the success of song recordings. The songs at the time tended to have a different kind of a chart life, and this is now, I guess it's gone full circle, because now that we have the sound scan type process for determining true sales, we don't have that that almost kind of bell curve kind of approach to mapping a recording's life in the marketplace, where it starts out, builds up momentum, peaks, goes back down. You get some crazy zigzags now in charting how recordings are going in the way of sales and general popularity. But back in those days, Tim did an excellent review of the Joel Whitburn book, Pop Memories, and I forget which publication, if it was a New Amberola. Was it the Arts Journal? Excuse me. In that particular review, he talked about how some of these recordings tended to stay, and certainly that was clear to me in looking at some of the record catalogs, where Murray songs would sometimes stay in almost 20 years. And really, the cutoff was kind of artificial for a lot of these, because you had that technological change to electronic recordings, where they just lopped off even what at the time were probably comparative bestsellers, but there was a mania to get everything recorded over in the new process. So a lot of the very successful acoustic recordings finally bit the dust. They were not actively marketed, and so who knows if the marketplace had stayed acoustic, how much longer some of these would have had a run. But they tended to, these recordings, stay in the catalog for years and years, and Tim refers specifically to one of the early Sousa recordings, and I'm not sure whether it was the Washington Post March or Semper Fidelis, but he said if there was truly a number one song, as Whitburn's publication indicated, and he had it neatly broken down into these little bell curve things, where something would be number one for 4 or 5 weeks and something else would come along, but he mentioned there that the Sousa recording in question may well have been number one for 5 years running at that time. So it was a different world, and I had to, as much as possible, kind of restructure my brain to think in those terms when I was looking at Murray and his role. One of the first things I felt it necessary to do, I guess this gets to probably the largest potential barrier here, and that was me. I felt that I certainly had some shortcomings that I was bringing into this. I think my absence in past ARS meetings may speak to part of this. I certainly felt I had some strengths, which committed me to doing the project. The fact that I was enthusiastic and had plenty of energy to bring to this project. I had a grounding in basic research methods. I had experience writing both journalistically and academically. And I had a fairly encyclopedic, I'd majored in history. In college, and had continued. That was a major hobby of mine, and a lot of that was in the music area, pretty much right from the beginning of the appearance of the phonograph. But I felt I needed to round that out more. So I read almost everything I could get that in the most indirect way had something to do with this period and with Murray's life, and this included reading about the Irish potato famines and the various immigration waves of the Irish to this country, histories of the cities where Murray and his family had lived, particularly Philadelphia, Denver, and New York City, studying the minstrel tradition and vaudeville's heyday, U.S. political and social movements from the Progressive Era all the way up to World War II. I already mentioned phonograph recording history. I continued to read in that area, and even inventions in the area of transportation and communication. In doing this, one of my co-authors, Dick Carty, at one point asked me if I didn't think it would be marvelous to go back and live in the early 1900s. At the risk of appearing sacrilegious, I told him no. I couldn't imagine life where air conditioning meant sitting on a block of ice and not having allergy pills. So that was the end of that bonding that we were going through on the phone. I might add, Dick's a little bit older than I am, and that may have something to do with it as well. Murray's songs themselves were a marvelous source of a goldmine, actually, for better understanding the times. A lot of his songs were topographical, and I thought this would be a good time maybe to take a break here and play a couple of them. These two songs are on the 515 by the American Quartet around 1915, and I thought commuting was something that really kicked in after World War II as a phenomena. And they're talking about suburbs way back before right around the World War I era. So that was kind of a revelation to me, not having experienced that firsthand. And the second song will be Take Your Girlie to the Movies, and this whole phenomena, the ritual of movie going and what motivated it was kind of interesting, and it was all marvelously presented in a 2-minute soundbite by Billy. I think I've got this set so it'll work.
Talk about your subway, talk about your ale, talk about your big car line as well. But when you're living out where the fields are green,
you got to go home on the 5:15.
You leave the office at 5 o'clock, stop at the butcher's for a steak or a chop, get the evening papers and a magazine,
and you run like the dickens for the 5:15.
For the 5:15, hear the whistle blowing, for the 5:15, your English all is slow,
for the 5:15.
Down the track you're going,
bang goes the gate for the 5:15.
Wifey's home awaiting, dinner in the pot,
dishes on the table and the fire red hot.
Get a loving message on the telephone,
you'll have to hit your baked potatoes all alone.
Next train home is the 7:38.
Bobby goes back to the corner to wait.
Meets the biggest crowd he's ever seen.
17 commuters miss the 5:15.
Oh, the 5:15. 17 commuters, oh, the 5:15. Lined up at the bar,
oh, the 5:15.
Their wives at home awaiting. Nobody home on the 5:15. Everybody's happy, everybody's glad.
It's about the 17th drink they have.
The Suburban Quartet singing home sweet home.
And hubby's all excited singing baritone.
He gets home about 1:30.
Carrying a steak and a chop and a bun.
The door is locked and the lights turned down.
So the steak through the transom and goes back to town.
For the 5:15. 17 commuters.
For the 5:15.
Still around the bar.
For the 5:15.
Hubby's back to join him.
Now there's a club called the 5:15.
Wifey's home a-crying, lying on the bed.
Hubby in the office with an awful head.
Little blue gloom's marching through his brain,
yelling all aboard the 5:15 train.
He gets to the station at 5 o'clock.
Forgets it is Saturday and gets a shock.
The guard says, hey, get out of the way,
the 5:15 doesn't run today.
Oh, the 5:15, the cause of all our sorrow.
Oh, the 5:15,
brought trouble to our house.
Oh, the 5:15,
wifey's gone to mother.
Bang goes the home on the 5:15.
Wifey's got a lawyer looking up the case.
Hubby's sneaking round the office in disgrace.
He's got no home and he's got no wife.
He's going to go on the alimony club for life.
He goes to court his case to fight.
Takes a look around and everything's all right.
The jury, the lawyers, the judge supreme.
All our commuters on the 5:15.
For the 5:15. The jury won't convict him.
For the 5:15.
They're going to set him free.
On the 5:15.
He always hit 400.
They're all pinochle players on the 5:15.
Gives advice to anyone in love. That's why Johnny Gray wrote to her one day. When I call to love my girl, her folks are always there. That's why I'm blue. Now what shall I do? And Beatrice said, never despair. Just take your girlie to the movies if you can't make love at home.
There's no little brother there who always squeals. You can say an awful lot in seven reels. Take your lessons at the movies and have love scenes of your own. Though she's just a simple little ribbon clerk, close your eyes and think you're kissing Billy Burke. Take your girlie to the movies if you can't make love at home. Sweethearts always use spoons in a big Morris chair. Young folks of today have a different way. Far away from cranky dad and mother's eagle eyes. It's lots of fun. Here's how it's done. So come on and give it a try. Take your girlie to the movies if you can't make love at home. Find a cozy corner where it's nice and dark. Don't catch influenza kissing in the park. Take your tip from Douglas Fairbanks and have love scenes of your own. Going to your seat, you've got a dandy chance. You can shine your shoes on someone else's hands. Take your girlie to the movies if you can't make love at home.
On the other hand, despite whatever I could bring this project, I felt I lacked the insider's perspective born of a lifetime of immersion in the particulars of the pre-electronic phase of phonograph history. This meant I might miss causal connections that would be readily apparent to a more well-rounded researcher. And worse yet, I thought I might have trouble acquiring the support of valued experts who might be put off by my relative ignorance of the subject. But regarding these experts, I greatly underestimated the generosity of spirit and shared commitment that they were displayed during my data gathering stage. They were with me every step of the way, providing the source materials I needed in order to be better informed. They ran the mail order operations, which supplied me with magazines, books, record catalogs, recordings, and phonograph equipment, as well as information and names of other valuable contacts. Kurt, are you in the room anywhere? He was certainly a prime example of that, probably the leading example. They worked in the archives, libraries, and local historical societies by which I supplemented the previously noted acquisitions. They helped explain the process of utilizing the various genealogical and vital records offices. They set up and conducted oral history interviews with key figures and supplied photographs and artwork relevant to my project. They freely supplied records and audio and videotape dubs from their private collections, sometimes even making materials available for outright purchase. I'm going to show a couple video examples of things and then follow it with a couple audio examples of some of these raw materials that I supplied. And I've got to tell you, this is just skimming the surface. I literally got hundreds and hundreds of these kinds of items. I skipped the more obvious examples with the video. For instance, the things where Murray was directly involved. There were pictures of him, for instance, at John Beeling birthday parties in the late 40s, mingling around, talking to Irving Kaufman and other famous artists that would get together at these affairs. This was about 1947 to 1950. And he also supplied the voice on a number of cartoons I think I mentioned before, and particularly with Walter Scanlon, earlier known as Walter Van Brunt, in a number of projects. And these are circulating among collectors as well and probably reside in some archives. The Victor 8 minstrel show from the late 20s, although they've lost the soundtrack to that from an old, I think, 16-inch disc, they do have the picture of that. I think UCLA, among other archives, has a copy of that. And these were all things which were readily available from collectors. But what I've tried to concentrate instead on is some of this background material, which helped me better appreciate the times that Murray operated in. The two selections I'm going to show little segments from include a PBS presentation called, I think it was Minstrel Man, came out a few years ago, which shows what Murray might himself have gone through in during that barnstorming period from roughly about 1893 to 1902 that was an important part of his life. The second segment includes an interview with Irving Caesar, who is one of the periods, the first couple decades of this century, one of the major songwriters. As a matter of fact, he was a lyricist with Gershwin. You'll see him referring here to Swanee and the role that Jolson played in putting that song across. And I could imagine if he'd inserted Murray's name in any number of songs that he and other songwriters had written at the time, saying a lot of the same things. So I found this sort of material invaluable. And why don't we go ahead and roll that now? I think I need to... There's one switch here. The output. Isn't there something over here? Okay. Yeah, try it. I think I've got it.
Celebrated clog dance with an assist from Mr. Tambo on the banjo and Mr. Bones on the boats. Seasons for me.
Can I name the four seasons?
If you can.
The four seasons, let me see. The four seasons is pepper, salt, vinegar, and mustard.
Mr. Tambo, I wonder if I can prevail upon you to favor us with a vocal rendition.
Well, I don't know about that, Mr. Interlocutor, but I'd be mighty pleased to sing a song for y'all. Although it ain't my color, I's feeling mighty blue. I's got lots of trouble, I tell it all to you. I'm suddenly disgusted with life, and that's a fact. Because my hair is woolly and because my color is black. I had my face enameled, I truly was a sight. Just as I was thinking, I had things fixed up right. My gal came down to see me, I gave her such a fright.
An American Winstead. And so he went up to his home one evening here in Manhattan, and in 15 minutes Swanee was born.
But how come the idea of the South, was that current at the
Dixie?
Just,
how does any idea come to...
Was Dixie current at the time?
Most writers. I mean, most of the boys who've written about Dixie had never been to Dixie.
I'm going to speed up on the these two audio examples. We're running out of time. Murray... still lives on in radio and commercial audio releases as well. I'm going to play very brief, I may not have time to get all the way through these, but two brief examples here. In Southern California, a number of PBS FM stations carry the Ian Whitcomb Show, which is devoted to old-time recording artists. And Dick Carty, who's one of my co-authors, has done frequent guest spots on Murray. This is an example from a 1993 program. And then right after that, if we have time, Jim Walsh himself cut a couple of tapes with Merritt Malvern Productions in Buffalo, New York, and these were distributed, were actually marketed mail order a number of years back, actually in the late 70s. There are many others, like the late John Dulow, Peter Dilge, who have marketed cassettes either in their stores or mail order, and other collectors who simply circulate through trades and just donations have made dubs available. The list of these people is endless. But here's the two examples.
With Harry's Tavern Band, and since I have the expert report on Billy Murray here, let's right away introduce you to the inimitable Dick Carty. Dick, welcome.
Gee, that's pretty spectacular. Are you the cohort?
No.
Oh.
This is just an
You, the studio band, incidentally, was a group of 10 union musicians. And the Billy Murray recorded 11 sides for Bluebird in 1940 and 1941. And that was his total contribution for Bluebird. He made one final record with Monroe Silver in 1943 for Beacon, which was owned by the Joe Davis.
But his voice was really gone by then, wasn't it?
I can't believe you said that.
Before we continue, Dick, you know, Billy Murray recorded a tremendous amount of records. Tell everybody approximately how many sides he cut.
The number that's commonly used is 6,000.
6,000?
Yes.
And you said that up until 1920, he sold more records than anybody else, any other...
Let me speed this up a bit and just get the Malvern part.
How many I already have?
Well, several thousand, anyway.
It's an awful lot. More than...
It's called He Goes to Church on Sunday.
I'm going to have to pass on that song. Good song, but...
She swallowed half the ocean and it made her show. She tried to cough, her foot flew off, she grabbed me by the throat. Her foot was made of cork, it started for New York. You're half afloat, go get a boat, I said. Oh.
Follow up on the success of their initial releases with parodies. That may be, yeah, well, we didn't get to hear Walt speaking, but that's okay. He has a nice voice. All the, you know, sounds like a true Southern gentleman. Any of you have heard those tapes? Let me finish up here, because I apologize for running over. The collectors and other experts also provided constructive scholarly criticism and even an outlet for publication. For instance, some of the articles I've been having run recently in the Victrola and 78 Journal, if any of you have seen those. Many of these lifetime collectors and enthusiasts considered the end product of my efforts, publication of a Murray biography, to be payment enough for their contributions. I made every effort to reciprocate in the exchange of audio, video, and print materials, as well as choice bits of information. The assistance of these experts, particularly in compiling the Murray discography, will be recognized by lengthy acknowledgments in the book. But two of the contributors ended up being so important, that was Dick Carty and Quentin Riggs, that I felt only fair to elevate them as co-authors in the project. One of the revelations just in general about this project was my discovery of this comprehensive network, which existed in order to facilitate the shared interest that the members of the network had in learning more about these pioneering artists. As a librarian and academic by trade, I'm appalled at how ineffectual our efforts at gathering information sometimes are, and I would certainly recommend that any researcher, no matter how much he or she knows about the subject at hand, reach out to these experts. That really was probably the most significant part of this whole project to me, is tapping into this and meeting all of the people out there that could help. If nothing else, the friendships that came out of that were something that that I'll always value. Another point or so here. It's ultimately, with all these gaps that I'd refer to, the problems in gathering information, and I cannot begin to tell you how many blind alleys I went up. One of the more interesting ones was a collector calling me about a Detroit weather anchorman named McMurray, who lived up in well, lived in the Detroit area, and he had evidently announced on the air that he was the great nephew of Billy Murray, and something about it didn't smell right to begin with. I couldn't imagine anybody announcing in the 90s to a general audience that as if this was something important, that that he was a relative of the late great Billy Murray. Maybe he was referring to the movie star. I mean, maybe, or that's what people probably thought he meant, Bill Murray. But at any rate, I couldn't figure out why the most people drop parts of their names when they're changing them instead of adding an MC. But I went ahead and spent considerable time trying to reach this guy, and I certainly knew he existed because when I called the station, they said, "Oh yeah, well he'll be in at 4 o'clock," and the guy just didn't seem to want to respond. It probably because in my explanation as to why I was calling him, he realized he had nothing to give. But after a few months, I just gave up. And this was typical of some of the blind alleys that I had to run down. But ultimately, where I had the gaps, I had to go with my own instincts and just good common research sense. And maybe somebody will come along with additional information, casting a new light on this subject after my book comes out. And this is certainly not something that I'm overly concerned about. After all, a researcher's ultimate goal is to discern the truth, no matter where it is and who happens to have it. And I welcome that, and I look forward to down the road myself maybe doing a second edition. But I hope all of you, when the book finally comes out, will pass along any additional advice or insights that you might have that you feel could make it even better.
Thanks, Frank. Chuck has an announcement about the banquet tonight.